Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Probably at this point, I have friends that are older, but I'm not as close. And he was, was significantly important person to me. I never would have expected that we wouldn't be speaking, really.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Our closest and longest relationships are often built on a foundation of sameness, the families we grow up in, the place we are from, the religion we practice. In your stories of estrangement, many of you talked about the jolt of realizing that someone you once thought of as similar suddenly appeared very different.
I am struggling with my best friend. Once Donald Trump began to arrive on the scene, he really began to focus on this sort of conspiracy narrative.
Juan is 50, a Colombian American who lives in Northern Virginia. He wrote to us about a close friendship that had recently fallen apart. They'd been friends since Juan was a teenager in Miami. His friend was one of the first Colombian Americans his age that Juan had ever gotten close to. They met at a party.
And I just showed up at this apartment with full of strangers. And at the end of the night, we ended up walking out together. He and I walked out together. And he literally said, "I think I'd like to be a friend with you. I'd like to be friends with you. You seem interesting." I was like, that's a unique approach. I like it. I'm like, let's be friends. Let's be friends.
Oh, that's nice. So he made it official.
Yes, he really did. I think it is something that is not common among mostly Latino men. He was always somebody who was just extremely affectionate and incredibly at peace with his way of being affectionate and kind.
They stayed close as they got older, even as their careers and life paths diverged. After Juan moved away from Miami in his 20s, he and his friend spent less time together physically, but they moved their conversation online, to email, and then to WhatsApp in a group chat with two other friends. In recent years, politics started coming up more and more, and it got uncomfortable for Juan.
I was the one sort of sole liberal in a group of four. And I think the momentum on Trump, on politics that was quote unquote outside of the mainstream was starting to ramp up.
What were the sorts of things that they were saying that they believed were sincerely held beliefs that sounded to you like conspiracy, but what was the language that they would use?
You know, Epstein, Clinton, one inch away from pizza pedophile in DC story. And I was just like, I cannot even go there. Let's not do that. I'm not somebody who supports pedophiles. It's absolutely cuckoo. And I was starting to make statements back saying, can we talk about our kids? Can we talk about sports? Can we talk about how our lives are going like we used to?
Hmm. And did you ever have a conversation with him where you said, like, where you sort of indicated that the friendship was at risk?
What happened with him was, I felt like I was sort of set up for a moment. He mentioned something. He asked for my opinion, and I felt that instead of receiving that opinion, he took it as a meatball that was being thrown at him, and essentially said, you know, I'm crazy for having my opinions, and I'm crazy for my political thoughts. And I responded and told him, well, the hubris that it takes to tell somebody how they should think is has to be pretty high. And that sort of blew it up. It blew it up pretty badly.
What happened? How does it blow up? All caps? Insults?
No. He insulted me. And oddly enough, he kicked me out of the WhatsApp group. Those other two guys were people I introduced him to. But he said, don't ever tell me to shut up again, and then the B word, and kicked me out of my own group of friends.
Bitch?
Yes. He said, don't ever tell me to shut up again, bitch. That's what he wrote. And he kicked me out.
When we talked, Juan told us he and his friend hadn't spoken in about a year. Juan is definitely not alone. According to a 2022 poll by the New York Times and Siena College, nearly one in five American voters, 19%, said that politics had hurt their friendships or family relationships. But ending a relationship with close friends or family over politics, or how you see the world, can feel extreme. You try to talk around it.
When I see them, it would just be a polite, hello, how are you?
She calls my sister and I in like super sweet mom voice, just trying to love us and have relationships with us and pretending that none of that is weird.
Do I just keep my distance from my family without saying anything, or should I say something?
I'm talking about anger and it's steaming and bubbling and about to boil over.
And then for some of you, there came a moment when your differences became two separate paths.
I said to him, like, do you understand what a big deal this is?
I said that I needed a break from the toxicity.
That I was done. And frankly, I don't forgive.
I told him not to speak to me until he could change his behavior and not yell at me. And to be completely honest with you, I've had a wonderful 3 years.
This is our second episode in our series about estrangement. Last week, we heard from a listener in the beginning stages, just thinking about estrangement, weighing what he would gain and all that he would lose. This week, we meet listeners who are estranged, and pretty recently. For some of them, estrangement feels like a fresh start, a shedding that brings with it a sense of relief. But even when it has felt really right, it's also sometimes been really sad.
If my parents had like died in a car crash 248 days ago, I think everybody around me would be like sensitive to the fact that I'm grieving. But because the estrangement is kind of this thing that there's no like public rituals for it, people might see me and I'm like high functioning, and yet I carry all that grief with me.
This is a listener we're calling Sonia. She's lived on a different continent than her Polish parents since she was in her 20s. She's now in her late 30s, living in Brooklyn with her husband, infant twins, and a 3-year-old. When she became a parent, one of the ways she tried to keep a connection with her parents was through language, and she spoke exclusively to her son in Polish.
It felt like it was our private, like, intimate language. It also felt very cumbersome because obviously for like the first years, the kid doesn't say anything. And so it just sounds like I'm talking to myself in this language. And like when other people would be around, I would sometimes feel self-conscious because they couldn't understand anything.
Uh-huh. Like you're muttering to yourself in the corner when in fact you're talking to your child. They're just not responding whatsoever.
Sonia's parents came to visit last Christmas. She hadn't seen them since before the pandemic. It was a big deal to get to share her family with them. And she did a lot to prepare.
Okay, so they were staying. So my mother-in-law has she has an apartment in Brooklyn. And so I made sure that they had like food there. I went grocery shopping. My dad drinks black tea. So I made sure they had black tea and the blankets on the bed. They're like all different in Europe. And so my mom had asked me to get her something that was more familiar. So I had ordered it on Amazon. I had gone and like changed the bed. I actually reorganized my son's room and removed it. He had Polish books, but they were in the minority. But I rearranged them so there would be a lot of Polish books on his shelf.
Visible. Uh-huh.
Visible.
Mm-hmm. What happened when they arrived?
So I picked them up from the airport and things seemed good. And then the next day they came together and they met my baby twins who were 6 months old. So there was a lot of like holding the baby, each baby. And then my son, who's 3 and a half, he's kind of a wild card. So first he like played with them, but then he was like, he also said things like, go away, or I want you to go home. And that happened very quickly. And I could sense that my dad was like having this like strong reaction that was like building up in him.
And then what happened?
Basically, one thing that started going on my nerves is my dad had, like, I became very aware that he was picking on me. So he would be like, you told us the wrong password for the Wi-Fi, or like you sent us to the wrong store. And like a lot of the times it was like his fault, like he had not listened. And so a lot of it would be like teasing me or picking on me. And I feel, I guess I had reached like a boiling point because I had just given birth to 2 babies and one of them had been in the NICU and like we haven't slept for like 3 months. And like any person who would like enter my apartment usually would come and like to help me. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first trigger that I said, well, I don't like you picking on me. And that led to like a first explosion. And then also over the time they had been picking on me, but also on my son. Well, like my son didn't want to speak Polish. And my dad just in Polish said like, you have to speak Polish. Like as if he would just push a button and like Polish would come out of my son.
This upset her a lot. Sonia decided she needed to try something different with her parents and be very direct. So she wrote them a letter.
That said like, I'm sorry we're having a hard time. I would love to spend like a good Christmas together. And then I said, you may not criticize me or my family. And so I gave my dad the letter. He like looked at it, he like threw it away. And then he said, I'm done. I'm not going to come for Christmas. And please tell your husband to rebook our tickets. And then my dad said this thing that sounded very rehearsed. And he said, I'm done with your son. Like, I'm not going to keep trying any longer.
With a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm. And then my mom said the same thing. We're not going to keep trying with your son. He's like, he's so disrespectful. And he's disrespectful because you're disrespectful. And I think that to me was so traumatizing when they said that they were done with my child that like the next day I said, I'm going to rebook the tickets just so they could return like 5 days earlier. Once they landed in Poland and they sent me the text like we landed, that's when I blocked their phone numbers and their email addresses.
Why did you do that?
Because I guess what I had realized during the visit was that I myself had like internalized a lot of stuff. So whenever they would get upset at me, I would blame myself. I would think like, oh, I did something wrong. And that triggered this maybe outsized reaction, but it was like partly my fault. But then when I saw how they treated my child, I just found it unforgivable.
Mm-hmm. When you saw the way that your father treated your 3-year-old child, did you recognize it? Is it ways that he treated you as a kid or even as an adult?
Yeah. The thing that I realized, the way my dad was treating my son would be like silent treatment. So he would go into my son's room and my son would say, I want to be alone, which is something I've been teaching him to assert his boundaries with everybody. But then like 5 minutes later, my son would come out and say to my dad, can you help me decorate the Christmas tree? And my dad would say no, because he was still upset that my son had like quote unquote rejected him.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I did recognize the patterns.
I think the tricky thing with maintaining boundaries, it can be, in my experience, I can get in these loops of like, I'm trying to like really inhabit the best intentions of the people that I know that they probably don't know that they're having this impact, or especially with parents, you know, where you see their limitations when you try to figure out if there's a way to come to a place of compassion and let them be how they are. When you think about your parents and you think about just how different your lives look right now and where you have lived and how people deal with emotional stress, how different that is, are there moments when you think, oh, this isn't only personal, this is also that we are living in different worlds?
I guess it's an interesting question, because my parents would, now that I was in the US, they would often use that against me. So my mom would say, like, I want to come and like stay with you for like a month or two. And I would say, well, I would prefer if you stayed like maybe 2 weeks. And then she would say, you're so American, you're so superficial, like you don't value hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a while I would kind of buy into that. But right now, where I'm right now, I just see it as like more universal patterns of like immaturity and manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think back to your question about the loops, I think that's what I'm struggling with the most, is like I have like rumination.
Mm-hmm.
And it's endless. And so a lot of the rumination is like, what could I have done differently? Like, could I have said it more gently, or could I have affirmed their feelings more? And I guess what I'm starting to understand is that whenever I feel guilt, it's actually a way to not feel sadness. Because whenever I think like, oh, I feel guilty if I had just done something differently, then I can tell myself like I could have some control over their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever I say like their behavior is abusive, then I have to deal with this kind of the sadness and the tragic of that.
Are you speaking Polish with your son?
No. And so the weird thing that happened is that as my parents left, and like that day I just stopped speaking Polish. I just can't bring myself to speak it, because the whole point of speaking Polish was to like pass that language on so my child or my children could speak with their grandparents. But the whole reason why I don't want to be in touch with my parents is that I don't want them around my children.
Yeah. It's now been about 8 months?
Yeah, or it's been 248 days.
Oh, you're counting the days.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to mention, like, the way I track time is like all the different ways, like the seasons change. But also because I have my twin babies, so when my parents were here, my twins, like, they were not very mobile. They had zero teeth. Mm-hmm. They had little hair, and now they have like lots of teeth, and they like both walk, and like the hair like is long and it curled up. And so anytime they meet a milestone, I think like, oh my gosh, like my parents are missing out on that. And it breaks my heart.
Is there a way that your parents could reach you if they tried right now?
Well, one thing that hasn't changed is my home address. And so I guess at some point I like fantasized that they would write like an apology and mail it. Mm-hmm. They could even call my husband, like he didn't block them.
When you fantasize about a letter coming in the mail with an apology, is there anything in particular you wish you would hear from them?
I mean, I guess like I fantasize about just a regular apology, which would be, we love you, we're so sorry we hurt you, we want to know how you're really feeling, and we want to do better. Please tell us how we can do better, because we really want to have a relationship with you. I guess maybe one thing that these fantasy parents in a fantasy letter could say would be, you're a good daughter and you're a good parent.
Coming up, another story of estrangement, one that started when a civil war divided a family.
So I traveled to Ethiopia on November 3rd, and I woke up to war the next day.
We've been talking with listeners about their stories of estrangement for months, reading every email and listening to every voice memo. And we heard from a lot of you about the stigma and shame around estrangement. It's not easy to broadcast that you aren't close with your family. Sadness and healing often happens in private. So if this is something you've gone through, we want to know what's helped you that might be helpful to someone else. As a book, whether fiction or nonfiction, or an online community, been helpful? Is there a movie or a phrase or saying that's been particularly useful in navigating through the dark woods of estrangement? We want to hear from you if you've chosen estrangement like Sonia, or if you're on the other side and estrangement has happened to you. What has helped you feel less alone? And what resources or advice would you pass on to someone else? You can email us or record a voice memo and send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. We'll share some of these responses in our weekly newsletter or in next week's episode. And if you don't already get our weekly newsletter, you can subscribe at deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Sometimes family rifts happen because someone did something. And other times, it's because of who someone turns out to be. Since Denona realized she was queer, she knew it was a matter of time before it caused a major rift in her family.
At some point in my life, I'm going to lose my family. And it was when I realized I was queer.
Denona was born in Ethiopia and came to the United States when she was 11. That's not her real name. She still hasn't told her family she's queer. That's not what has caused them to break apart, like she expected it one day might. Instead, it was war. Specifically, the civil war that broke out in Ethiopia 2 years ago.
Seeing, like, the sheer amount of Ethiopians that were pro-war, pro-genocide, pro-a siege, and denying everything as it was happening. So I'm like, I have nothing in common with these people. Nothing.
Hundreds of thousands have died from violence and famine. Denona has family on both sides of the conflict. 3 half-brothers who share a father with Denona, and their wives, who live in the U.S., support the government, who has targeted violence in an area called Tigray, where Denona's mother is from.
There's always, like, a threat of, like, being arrested, being disappeared.
Even as her mother was in danger, Denona noticed her siblings in the U.S. didn't bring it up with her.
Over time, I noticed that they did not call me. They didn't text me. They didn't call my mom. And I was just wondering, like, what's going on? Like, why aren't they at least calling to say, like, have you guys heard from family in Tigray?
Mm-hmm. Are you safe? Are they safe?
Yeah, are they safe? Have you heard anything?
Then Denona went on Facebook and saw that her sisters-in-law were celebrating the war, saying that people from Tigray, like her mother, deserved the violence that was coming to them and should be starved out.
I was so confused and sad and heartbroken. I didn't know, like, how to even broach the subject. Like, I didn't know how to talk to them about it, so I didn't.
I understand that since you first wrote us, you sent a text.
Yeah.
What did you want to say to your family members?
So I said, I'm really heartbroken, really sad and traumatized by the lack of care they showed regarding my family and the genocide. And if I feel ready when I feel ready, I will reach out.
And did they respond?
Yes, they responded so immediately. I didn't expect them to. They responded, and one brother accused me of choosing one side of my family over the other. And that made me feel so angry, because I just knew that he doesn't know me. So I was like, okay, well, what am I losing? And then I blocked him.
You blocked him.
Mm-hmm.
After that encounter over text, were you by yourself?
No, I wasn't. Thankfully, two of my friends were in the house, so I just ran to them and told them to, like, hug me and, like, tell me I'm going to be okay and, like, help me craft a response.
Do you feel, I realize it's still quite fresh, but since that text exchange and finding comfort with these friends, have you started to think differently about who is your family that you can rely on?
Yes. Yes. The type of love I experience from my friends doesn't even come close to the type that I have with my family. I don't even know how to describe, like, what I have with my family, because it doesn't feel like love, because it doesn't feel welcoming, like, to who I am as a person. So much of
how we first come to understand our identity comes from the family where we grow up and the place where we come from.
Yeah.
And I wonder if losing a sense of connection with both of those things, feeling like you don't belong with those identities anymore. Like, do you feel like you're having to sort of rewrite who you are?
Yeah. I feel like I've been doing that for a while now. Like, knowing as, like, an immigrant, a Black queer immigrant, like, I'm never gonna feel like I belong here. And I go back to Ethiopia and I have to, like, negotiate everything about myself, make myself palatable for safety reasons. And my ideas and my views have been tested and they've changed. And I'm making very intentional choices about who I am and how I want to live my life. And that makes me feel like I belong to myself. And I belong to people like my friends, to other queer immigrants from East Africa.
Can you describe, like, paint a picture for me of when you've recently felt that sense of belonging? Like, where were you? Who were you with? What were you doing?
It's been happening a lot. I remember me and my Eritrean American friend went on a bike ride, like, on a trail.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, like, biking for a while and playing music, taking turns playing music. And I felt like in that moment, all of my identities were being seen, because they also speak Tigrinya. And we can, like, make jokes about our culture and, like, talk about our culture, like, the commonalities in our cultures.
Your friend is also queer?
Yes. Yeah, like, I felt like I could hold, there was enough space for everything.
After the break, someone on the other side of estrangement, a mother who received a letter 4 years ago from her daughter, cutting off their relationship.
I must have read it several times, and just, like, the earth opened up in a way I just couldn't have imagined. Just a real tectonic wow.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. When we first started gathering your estrangement stories, we asked you to share how it felt. Was it like a long pulling away or like flipping a switch? For Danona and Sonia and others who did the estranging, it was both. A confusing lead up and then a clear moment of decision. And being able to block people on their phones made the cut cleaner. For people on the other side of estrangement, who've been blocked or abruptly estranged from, that suddenness can feel unbelievable, like another reality.
Went out to the porch. It was January and it was cold. And I remember picking up the note and being so excited by having a note from my daughter. And then I just opened it and just read the words and time stopped, I think.
A listener we're calling Megan is in her 50s, divorced, and lives alone in coastal Maine. 4 years ago, when she opened the note from her daughter, who was 27 at the time, the reasons she listed for why she wanted no more contact were vague. But what was clear was that her daughter did not want her mother reaching back out for more explanation.
Mostly it was she needed me to stop trying to contact her, and that if in the future, wherever we're to cross paths or we were to see one another, that she would treat me coolly. She was preparing me for this is a long thing I need. So. Mm-hmm.
One of the difficulties of these interviews, Megan, that we've been having around estrangement is that it can be quite difficult to, just sort of figure out what happened because the points of view can be so starkly different. To the best of your ability, at this point now, thinking about what your daughter experienced in her relationship with you and why she wanted to create a lot of distance and boundaries and new rules, why do you think she wanted to become estranged from you?
It's a question I've pondered a lot. And I think some of my lack of communication skills and inability to see her.
What do you mean by that?
I think about it now in the wake of the split up. We had my ex and I would call a good divorce, but I think now knowing what I know, perhaps wasn't that way for my children because they were confused because there was a lot of emotional things going on, but probably the stoic in myself and their father, we never got messy about it. We got messy, but not messy about it, Our range of emotional literacy didn't go much beyond happy, sad, love, and I'm angry. And again, those things were not encouraged to dwell or to root around in any of those kinds of, I'm sorry to hear that, can you tell me more? We didn't do that kind of chat. And I don't know if it was because we didn't grow up having that or because we were afraid of them, of somebody falling apart.
Megan said she raised her children with the tools she was given from her mother. Megan's mother is still living and in her late 90s now. And when she heard about what was going on, she wrote her own letter. If this continued, she wrote to her granddaughter, there would be no inheritance.
You're not welcome here. And furthermore, anything you might have gotten when I pass is not coming to you. It was pretty straightforward.
Is that threat still in place?
Yes.
You haven't challenged your mother on that?
No.
How do you know that she wrote to your daughter?
I was there when she asked me. It was within weeks I was visiting her, and it was within weeks of the note. And again, yeah. So, and she told me she was going to do it, and I didn't. I was pretty raw in those months. I didn't know much about how to do anything about the situation. Mm-hmm. I did not research, you know, the whole issue. I didn't go online to find a like-minded, you know, group of people that this has happened to try to find the answers. And I didn't want to go down a rabbit hole of wallowing about it. So I didn't, with my mother, I just didn't know. I just wasn't trying to, I didn't know what the right answer was. So I just let her do what she felt she needed to do.
Mm-hmm. When you say it, wallow there, I hear you. I hear that stoic part of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And luckily I've got girlfriends that are pretty damn good about calling me on my stoicism and saying, you know, you're really feeling. and then the tears come and then it's like, okay. Yeah. It's really humbling being human. It's so humbling being a parent.
That's what I want to hear you reflect on. How do you think about parental love and what you can expect from it as a mother?
Yeah. You know, I think most of us, I could be wrong, but I certainly entered parenthood with a great deal of enthusiasm and energy. And I have to say, when I got that note in the mail, I had that very, very visceral sort of, it's not right. All those years and all of that energy. And one of the things that's shifted for me over the course of the 4 years is a great deal of respect for my daughter, for having the courage to send that note. It can't be easy, because it's nice to have a mother. And so, you know, this is the roots and wings. This is the wings part. They got to be able to fly the nest. And if they don't come back, they don't come back. And it's not up to me. It's only, our children are the only ones who know what they need. And while I wish like heck, you know, they felt like they enjoyed, you know, their parents, I can't force it. So doesn't always work. Family bonds don't work.
That was a listener we're calling Megan. A couple of updates since we've taped these interviews. Out of the blue, Juan's friend sent him a conspiracy video on YouTube about the coronavirus. A couple of weeks later, Juan reached out to his friend during Hurricane Ian to check if he was safe. And since then, they've exchanged a few texts. Danona says she still hasn't spoken to her half-brothers living in the United States, and she's had extremely limited contact with her family in Ethiopia. In early November 2022, both sides of the conflict committed to a ceasefire, but Danona says she still worries about her family. And as of this episode's release, it's been 345 days since Sonia has talked to her Polish parents. On the next and final episode of this series, we hear from Juliet, who decided to see her mother after years of not talking.
It's the, like, what is she going to look like? What are we going to talk about? What should I say? And, like, you know, how do I greet this person? Do we hug? Do I shake her hand?
You can find every episode of this series on our website at deathsexmoney.org/estrangement. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Zoe Azoulay. The rest of our team is Liliana Maria Percy Ruiz, Afi Yellow Duke, Tracy Hunt, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Andrew Dunn, who composed original music for this series. Julia Furlan and Lily Clark also worked on this series. The Reverend John Delour and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Instagram at AnnaSailPix, that's P-I-C-S. The show is at Death Sex Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you to Sarah Brown in Charleston, West Virginia, for being a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money and supporting us with a monthly donation. Shout out to my hometown. You can join Sarah and support what we do here by going to our website at deathsexmoney.org/donate. One thing Sonia left me thinking about was how tricky it can be when you're setting new relationship boundaries based on the behavior of a three-year-old.
There was also like a moment where my son like hit my dad. But again, like my son, like it's the same kid who like a year ago would like lick the electrical outlets. Like it's like a kid, right?
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.